It's the Garden Nerd Tip of the Week podcast, where we spend time chatting with expert gardening guests and we ask for their favorite tip. I'm Christy Wilhelmi. Thanks for joining me. My guest today is Rose Lawrence of Red Bread, an award-winning bakery in Los Angeles. Red Bread focuses on wild yeasted breads and pastries made with whole grains. Rose is a professional chef, baker, master food preserver, and is actively involved with food justice issues. You may have seen her on Hallmark Channel's Home and Family Show and the Food Network's Food Factor Fiction. And also, her work and recipes have been featured in the LA Weekly, the LA Times, and more. Thanks for chatting with me, Rose.
Hi, I'm so happy to be here.
Yes, and I wanted to ask, do you remember how we met?
It was in your gardening class.
At Santa Monica College.
At Santa Monica College, that's right, that's right.
Yes.
I remember, if I remember correctly, I was having trouble enrolling, and I think I had to reach out to you ahead of time and, like, get approved, or I had to, like, get someone to let me, like, off a wait list because I was, like, desperate to start a garden. I was very persistent.
And you walked into that class with a pink pastry box full of what I believe at the time was your signature cookie. That was, do you remember?
Yeah.
What was it?
It was our cracked cookie.
Yes.
It was our cookie that we'd won the best cookie in LA for, like, only a couple weeks earlier, actually.
And I got exactly one of those cookies, and then they were scarfed down by the rest of my students, and an empty box came back to me at the front of the room. I was like, you guys, come on. But I thought, you know, and you had the box was stamped with the Red Bread logo, and you were just starting up at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, you were...
Like, we'd been at the farmer's market, yeah, but we were trying to get a brick and mortar going.
Right.
Yeah.
And that was the... I have to say, one of the best cookies I've ever eaten. It was delicious.
Thanks. I had totally forgotten about a lot of that, actually. I do remember at the time being, like, I wanted to share the cookies because my mother always taught me never to arrive empty-handed to school.
Oh.
But I was a little late, and then I was so embarrassed when I walked in and, like, stole the glass.
But everyone's eyes lit up when you came through that door. They were like, cookies? You know, a totally unexpected joy of the class. So... I just want to thank you for doing that, and I hope that it brought you more business down the line, because that's the best way to introduce yourself. Here, I'm Rose. Have a box of cookies.
With treats. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. So let's start with Red Bread. How you decided to bake with whole grains and wild yeast. What's your story?
So I feel my story is like... I don't know, a great choose your own adventure, because there were many things. Like, I had my head to do a lot of different careers, and then I sort of ended up doing what I do, and everything I'd done prepared me for it. So, you know, not all who wander are lost. but I had been in law school when I was here in California at UCLA, and I had been baking a lot in law school, as I had been doing most of my life, and was actually the president of my class because I made a lot of cupcakes.
Excellent.
So when I got out of law school, I was a little burnt out on a lot of things I'd been working on, and I started baking more, and I had a little break enough from, like, a very intensive education I'd just undergone to do some what we call hobbies. Uh-huh. And I had grown up with a mother and a father who'd run a small cafe, and it had a garden that supplied the cafe. And this was when I was tiny, you know, and then, like, the aftermath when they split up and the restaurant closed was that I just had a mother who loved to cook with whole grains. And at the time in the early 80s, and I would be sent to school, it was like very strange. Like, no one wanted to trade me their snack pack for my, like, quinoa pudding.
Oh, hey.
So that was a challenge. But now, you know, like, those things that I just grew up with and then, you know, for a long time to be cool, like, pushed away, have been the very things that, like, define my own cooking and are very... let's just diplomatically say on trend now, that mm-hmm. we understand what they do more and where they're coming from and their nutrition value, and also just, like, all that aside, because that's very convincing, but it's abstract, they're delicious.
Yes. And I remember taking a class from you at Grain School 2016, where you were teaching, it was a pastry class. We made eclairs and some other delicious things that were made with whole grains. They were completely milled fresh with the whole grain, and you couldn't tell. They were absolutely as light and fluffy as white flour. Can you talk about how that works for you?
Yeah. Well, like, it's not just me. A lot of that is, you know, the whole chain. So the farmer, the miller, and the baker. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think it's right now people want to be everything and do everything. And it's almost ludicrous for me to remark on this because there's no one who wants to be everything and do everything more than I do. And yet you can learn those things and gain a mastery of understanding. But it's the people who really fall in love with the daily craft who there is still not only space for, but they're so necessary. And there are things that, you know, when we first met and I was making that cookie, I thought that was the best cookie anywhere. That's why I made it. LA agreed with me, and it has only gotten better because since then, Nan Kohler of Grist and Toll has come onto the market, and,
right.
You know, we do a lot of home milling now, and that's so exciting, but we are talking about crushing this seed
mm-hmm.
that has more nutrition than per like size
mm-hmm.
Than any other food, really, if
right.
properly handled. And when you crush it so fast on these home mills that are like 3 inches radius, it's like it's hot, it's hard, the granulars are large.
Yeah.
But when you do it on a sizable mill, it becomes this powder, even when totally intact, because everything's been slowly broken down. And so it's the same idea. Like, I am slowly breaking down on a molecular level doing sourdough, and she is slowly breaking with physics, right? Like chemistry and biology, same thing.
Uh-huh.
And what this gives me is a flour that is fine enough that it doesn't do what we used to think was the whole grain problem, which was that bran, like, just shredded
gluten,
right? Which is still true, but if it's also tiny and you adjust for time and you get to know each grain, like we would get to know broccoli versus spinach,
mm-hmm.
Or even like more like thinly, like rapini versus broccoli,
yes.
you know, uh-huh. like we can split even more hairs, then it works,
yeah.
right? So like, from there, I know we were doing a pâte à choux class, and we did rye and red fife and brown rice,
mm-hmm.
I remember.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, so there was a gluten-free one.
Yes.
And part of the reason why I chose those three is because they were so different. But pâte à choux, also, you're getting the majority of your strength from the eggs.
Mm-hmm.
So understanding the flours I was working with and the element I wanted to show, which was there are so many applications besides bread where strength and fluff is an aim. There are so many ways we could incorporate whole grains where structure is not as important. So
mm-hmm.
why are we getting hung up on that?
Yeah.
And so my attempt was to show how you could adjust just knowing science of pâte à choux
mm-hmm.
for different grains if you were to consider that it was a variable that was like 60% of your ingredients. So if you could make it taste like something instead of nothing, like, I just feel like the math there is undeniable.
Right. And I think people don't understand or know because they haven't had that experience of tasting the same. Well, Nan Kohler of
Grist and Toll. Pasadena.
Yeah. So Nan Kohler of Grist and Toll made 3 cookies with the exact same recipe using 3 different wheats. And we tasted them side by side. And they're a world of difference. They're absolutely different. And I think most people are so conditioned to think wheat tastes like wheat no matter what it is.
Right.
They don't understand that or know or have been exposed to the difference that's available to them with whole grain. The heirloom and heritage whole grain varieties that are available to us now.
Well, it's also just like in your sentences right there, we've said so many words that aren't regulated that we don't all agree on, right?
Uh-huh.
Like, what's whole wheat? What's whole grain? What's heirloom? What's ancient? What's heritage?
Uh-huh.
What is a land race? Like, some of these words mean something, but only to like certain sects,
yeah.
and other of them are just plain marketing. And I feel like the biggest one that's worth teasing out in the limited time we have, all of these are worth teasing out. Is that for most people, they think, oh, whole wheat, got it. And that really, on the market, just means brown.
Yes.
And there's no traceability. So why I think you should look for whole grain as opposed to whole wheat is because if it says whole grain, 9 times out of 10, it's going to say what grain?
Yeah.
Because that's what you're trying to say. And organic, local, try for local as best you can, because mm-hmm. that's going to be more sustainable and chances are it's smaller and therefore probably organic just for like default.
Yeah.
And you know, ask these great questions, but it is kind of confusing out there as to like what even any of it means versus availability. There are a bunch of mills in the United States. People are milling differently. This is a craft on the rise.
Yes.
So like you can find one in your region, you know. Nan also ships nationwide. Just want to plug my girl.
I know. It's so, we are very fortunate here in Los Angeles to have a local mill that in Grist and Toll, and they're in South Pasadena in an industrial building that you would never notice if you were driving by it, which I had done probably 3,000 times.
Yeah. Like,
that's where Grist and Toll is. But yeah, so they have, anyway, I digress. These local mills people can find all over the country. I think I posted a link on a previous podcast to where people can find those, because there is a website that shows where the, you know, all over the country where you can find local
mills. Barton Springs in Texas is incredible. Capay is incredible. Anson is great. Like they are there. They just mm-hmm. need people to connect with them. And, you know, people who are doing these things are doing it for the love of it and are bringing back a craft to, like, for a lot of, you know, a lot of us don't even know what the words are to talk about it.
Yeah.
Because as things like die out of our activities, we tend to lose those words. So it's a really wonderful thing to support on a personal level or a restaurant level. There's right. there's so many ways to like begin to use them before you even have to like sort of face that fear of like, oh my god, things are going to change so much, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I enjoy sharing that because I do think those things, they taste so good. So good.
They
and
do.
There's such a potential for a revolution of taste, right? Because the narrative before about whole grains was like, they're good for you, so eat them. It was like,
and
well,
they
kind of
taste like
marijuana.
Yeah. Right.
Right. And then instead, let's talk about how, like, if we learn a little bit more about them, if we pay a little bit more attention, mm-hmm. then we can make them truly delicious. We can help them shine.
And you're doing that through Red Bread. Back to Red Bread.
Hopefully.
So continue the story. So you started... Did you start in a rental commercial kitchen, or how did you...
Yeah, we really started with our bootstraps. We started with a loaf of bread, a whole grain loaf of sourdough bread, completely naturally leavened, and we started with this craft cookie, which was this oat walnut chocolate cookie.
Mm-hmm.
And we started with a electric bike and delivering to local cafes, and we convinced a local cafe who had a commissary kitchen to let us use it. It was technically illegal at the time. Now, like, LA has supported a lot more, like, incubators and things like that, but we were able to get that started, and we focused on those two products. And then we started at the Santa Monica Farmers Market, mm-hmm. which was really great for us because it expanded our audience. And I was just really possessed. Like, I made a loaf of bread, and from the one loaf of bread I made, it just felt instantly, like, so good. Like, even before I put it in the oven, I was like, I don't even care if this is a complete failure. Like, just on my hands, this feels so good. I just know I'm going to do this again.
Yeah.
There's no other choice. And then, like, I made, like, one loaf of bread, and the next day I made 24 loaves of bread, and the next day I made 78 loaves of bread, and, like, when I spread out all the loaves, it was like, well, I mean, I could either go broke and be buried with all my loaves, or I could try and sell these. Like anything, you look back and you're like, oh, wow, like, that's what I thought was the hype, but it was great. And when I did give it to people, they had this, real visceral reaction, like they'd, like, seen this before, and they couldn't quite tell where, but they were just so convinced it was going to be great, and then it was. And I think that so often there's so many foods in this world, and just the standard for food in this world is like, I have these high expectations of what I want, and then it doesn't taste like it. Mm-hmm. And then you eat more and more to try and satiate this idea.
Yeah.
And it's because we've, like, stripped so much out of our food, and going back to this like flip and starting so basic and using, you know, sort of kind of using psychology against people. Like, I made bread and a cookie. Like, I was trying to get you, you know, like I went for your stomachs hard.
Yeah.
It was, I think people just instantly recognized something real. And that's more than anything what I was after, because I wanted something real. I had lived so many places around the world where I had had real bread and not realized we were missing that. Mm-hmm. And I mean, there's so many side shoots about like health and, you know, things like that, that like ultimately led me to like the ethos I have. But when I go back, it's like, it's the same ones that my parents had that I just didn't understand because I was young and, right, and knew it. But it was so charming. Like, when we had opened we eventually opened a brick and mortar through a Kickstarter campaign that mm-hmm. the community supported, which was quite the ride and phenomenal and terrifying and all those things. But my mother came to visit, and I was so excited to take her to the bakery and show her how to make bread, and I, like, you know, really put on a show. And she was so sweet and like listened to me, and then when I was done, she proceeded to tell me about how she made bread for 7 years every day. It was really beautiful.
Nice.
Yeah.
So on your website, you sell not only the cookies and the pastry things, but you also sell preserves. So does this tie into you being a master food preserver?
Yeah, so I pretty much right before I did your class, mm-hmm. I had found out about the Master Food Preservers here in Los Angeles, which is a wonderful organization. And it used to be, my personal teacher was this man named Ernie Miller, who passed away recently.
Yes.
He was rest in peace indeed. He was an incredible teacher. He was very passionate about what he was doing. I learned so much from him. And it was a great program because I didn't realize, like, I didn't know these skills, but I also didn't realize how not that long ago more people knew these skills.
Yes.
And again, like, in my travels, I was suddenly like, oh, it's actually quite rare that the people it's rare for me, but also everyone knew how to do it because it was closer to survival.
Right.
And I loved this. I remember feeling so in love with preservation, and I think what allowed me to like kind of throw myself at it and therefore absorb it so fast was this idea of what was first, like growing things or preserving them, and how we had to just do it constantly on the fly. And it was just this like the oldest science that man has ever known is magic, right?
Yeah.
I love that. And that's just, it felt like there was so much magic in preservation, especially fermentation, which is what I ended up doing like my end school project on, specifically like charcuterie.
Mm. Oh.
But a lot of pickles and using whey and sort of zero waste from the garden was just that you were really embracing like another biological being and getting so much for it. So it was an extension of sourdough, just like a different ferment. But the jams, yeah, I fell in love with jam making really, really hard. And we happened to have a lot of citrus trees in our yard at the time. Mm-hmm. And I was using them primarily to make curd for the bakery. And when I learned how to make marmalade and jam, that quickly became something ongoing. So we sell limited batches of seasonal jams that I pair with different herbs from the garden. So whenever I'm making these preserves, my goal is not only to bring out the fruit, but also all those wonderful smells you get only when it's alive and on the branch.
Mm-hmm.
That perfume that you kind of lose pretty quickly.
Yeah.
But it smells like other things that grow close to it. So I'll often pair like plums with lavender because I feel like it not enough to make it taste like lavender, but enough that when you spread it or move it, you get this.
The aroma comes
up. Yeah.
Nice.
And I find that it's just, for me, it's about creating that sensory experience because I love so much being outside. The garden has always been really, that was my first home.
So what do you like to, what are some of your favorite things to preserve? I know you said the lavender and the plum, but like you said, you had citrus trees. So what are your favorite things to do with that?
So right now I have a blood orange tree that's just dripping.
Mm-hmm.
And I really like to pair that with rosemary.
Oh, yeah.
Because I think that there's some lovely tannins that get brought out from the blood orange with rosemary. So I'll use some sprigs and sink it in while the marmalade's being made. And then I'll pull those out and finish it off the heat with some of the flowers. So there's a little, you know, a little something pretty.
So exotic. Wonderful.
I mean, it really came about just because there's literally a rosemary bush right next to it.
Yes, and they're prolific here in Southern California and many places of warm climates.
Yeah, so I really, those are the kinds of things I try to put together. And I grew up in Ecuador, so I'm always after these tropical fruits that randomly show up at our markets because there'll be just some guy growing it and he's got enough of it this week. So I've taken like tropical melons and Meyer lemons, which are very seasonal right now, and like sunk those in and combined it with some sort of like bubbling Chardonnay to wow. create like a melon jam that's using the pectin from the Meyer lemon. So trying to use that chemistry, which mm-hmm. is a lot of what I learned in the Master Food Preserver, to make some things that seem like you've had them before. You probably haven't.
It sounds wonderful. I feel like there's a cookbook in that in there somewhere.
Working at things.
All right. Well, so when we're talking about food preservation and those lost skills of survival, it makes me wonder if this somehow tied into the food justice issues for you, or if those things are separate. What brought you to food justice issues?
So one of the strongest links from my law school pass and my baking present was that I was doing a lot of work in international human rights law, mm-hmm. and the similar issues are the same across the globe, which it tends to be issues of access and distribution, mm-hmm. whether that is natural resources or food or education. It tends to mostly involve women and the disabled because they're vulnerable communities. So just through those interests of mine, food kept coming up, mm-hmm. and I began to just know a lot of things about different systems and learning things about how we're perfectly capable of growing enough food on this planet to sustain everyone.
Yes,
but again, it's a chain of distribution,
yeah.
And also a large part of change of heart and a change of inclusion. You know, we can't hope to solve problems without involving the people who are living in those problems.
Yeah.
Just was a lot of what I worked on as doing capacity building and food. And because I'd lived in many places and I'd been exposed to different dishes and food systems and values and for how cuisine was handled and consumed, I had this very relativism approach to things. And when I came back to the United States and I was suddenly, you know, I was an adult and going to law school and thinking about these food systems, I saw that so many things that we were trying to solve elsewhere were happening here too.
Yeah.
What I'd learned from that was about how you could create small, strong communities, and if those linked up, you would eventually see that grow. So one of the biggest things that you have in capacity building is this need for education. And when we started in 2011, no one really knew what I was talking about when I would try to have a conversation about, oh, this is a whole grain bread, and it's sourdough, it's wild yeasted, it's naturally leavened. These were all these terms of art that just, like, flying over people's heads. And it became very apparent, like, if we were going to do this, we were not only going to have to make a great product, but we were also going to have to be willing to spend a significant amount of our time having the same conversation over and over with people just to get them on board. forward. Even if they didn't purchase anything, this was going to be a mission of sorts.
Yeah.
And I, you know, I had just come from this education of debate and high research, and I was pumped enough that I was like, okay, I'll do it. and that's what it was like. Standing at the farmers markets was just talking about like, what was whole grains? Why does it matter? Who does it link up? How does it restore biodiversity in our fields? Why does that matter? How you can make a bigger change, not giving up gluten, but embracing it in more detail. Yes. With greater understanding, because there are consequences to any action. Why not learn what they are instead of go running from them?
I
tried to connect with a lot of places too. So I worked with the St. Joseph Center a lot. Mm-hmm. And I taught a class we called Food Justice there. And the aim of that class was manyfold. I tried to have a lecture where we talked about how our food system works, how it's not the only food system in the world, mm-hmm. how it's not even the best one necessarily for all the following reasons, how your food system is linked to your medical system, what laws are currently up for a vote that you are qualified to have a voice on. And I would just run these through once a year, and at the end of class would end with a sampling of any kind of preservation, because again, like, we can speak to your mind and we can tell you how to like get fired up and how to take a step towards the right direction, but unless we put it in your mouth,
yes,
which thankfully it's totally fine to say that about
food, yes, it is.
I'm not going to be able to change your heart or your stomach, really. So then we would taste all these things, and then I would teach them a preservation skill. And the idea was to show them that, you know, because I can tell you, like, listen, your dollar goes a lot farther to support your community if you go to the farmer's market, mm-hmm. but you know, you have very little, most of us have very little disposable income, and we all love food. There's no such thing as a foodie. If you're alive, you're a foodie.
You eat.
You eat, yeah. And we want to eat better, but we don't know how. And so any purchase is sort of a risk. So I think that when you go to the farmer's market and I ask you to buy in bulk because it's cheaper and preserve it. Like, if you don't know those skills also, like, you can't take advantage of that. So it can't be just one pronged. It has to be something where, like, this is going to involve more of you, but it's also going to have these great rewards. And it's not as hard as people have made you think it is.
Yes, it's fantastic. I know people wonder, you know, how do you have so much time to cook? I don't. My office is in the kitchen, so I can cook while I'm working. But it's a matter of, like, making a big batch of something and keeping it in the fridge for all week long, mm-hmm. and buying in bulk. It is affordable because of that. And buying from the farmer's market means your money goes back into the local economy.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Also, I feel like something that used to be very popular that's been lost is this idea of doing big batches and at scale, but in a group, mm-hmm. like where you would get together with your friends on a weekend and you would all make pasta and you would make an obscene amount of pasta because many hands make light work. And then you would go home with so much pasta, you know, and like these things like marmalade and jam making. It's so much better when everyone has a pot. You all sit around, you do an old fashioned, what I like to call stab and gab.
Stab and gab. Do tell.
I'd really like this to take off, but it's the same as just, like, you know, your grandma's sitting around gossiping. I hate to use those words because I feel like they're loaded, but basically you just sit around and talk, and by the end of it, all your oranges are shredded or all your apples are cored.
Right.
And then again, you stand around and stir, and by the end you have like enough for the year. Mm-hmm. And it's like, these used to be social events, and now we're all like, oh my God, you want me to make jam by myself? I don't. I want you to have a party.
That's a great idea. And just on a side note, with regard to preserving food preservation, it always ties into food waste. And I'm just going to throw this in here because I've recently taken a drawdown course about the book Drawdown, edited by Paul Hawken. And reducing food waste is the number three solution suggested by the Drawdown Coalition, which is a team of scientists who research the biggest contributors to greenhouse gases on our planet. And preserving prevents food waste. So not to mention you'll be prepared for emergencies. So I'm just going to throw that out there as a little aside.
What's one and two?
One is refrigerant management, which is so not sexy, but it's a matter of making sure that if you throw your refrigerator away and everyone in the world throws it away, they don't just tumble it down a hillside somewhere. They actually take it to some place to have the refrigerant properly removed and not just thrown into a landfill. And it's a bunch of other things, too. CO2 production from refrigerant. We have CFCs in the world still happening, even though they've been banned in the United States. And number two is wind turbines. So offshore, you know, energy. It always comes down to energy. But I will just say that in the top 20 solutions, 8 of them are food related. So it's a
interesting.
It's a, you know, food is everything, and well, everybody eats,
and everybody can be a part of it as a result, because these other things require a lot more sort of agreement on the level of like governing bodies to make happen. But food waste is something you can absolutely do on your own. And it's funny because, again, it's like we haven't really been taught how to do that. And I see a lot of cookbooks out there that are like cooking with scraps or cooking with this. And it's really a challenge, but it's nice to see that more people are interested in not just like composting or even preservation, but there are so many ways to just change your cooking method a little, mm-hmm. or cook one part of something slightly longer. Like, for instance, kale. Traditionally, people like will rip the big spine off,
yeah.
and that's like for the compost or something. But you know, if you dice that up really small and throw it in with the ripped leaves, it will cook in the same amount of time and has wonderful nutrition. Or if you were to like roast that a little, then you could steep it and make a tea. So like, there's so many ways you could just like play. And I think maybe that's really it. We need to allow people to like play with their food, mm-hmm. not at the table, but in the kitchen. Yeah.
Excellent. Well, I look forward to your upcoming book about this. I'm just saying. So is there anything that you grow that you use? I mean, do you have a garden right now? And are you using any of things that you grow or have grown in your baked goods?
So right now it's winter, and even though that's California, I don't have a lot growing in my garden except for herbs. Mm-hmm. I always try to have herbs growing. I always have lavender and rosemary for sentimental reasons, mm-hmm. but they're also delicious. And I love keeping sage and lemon balm and tarragon. I use a lot. I love herbs. I think they're so versatile. Like, they flavor things. They can be a salad on their own. They go into preserves.
What do you use lemon balm for?
Mostly as a joke as I walk through the garden. Because I like calling it Melissa.
Oh.
And so when I walk people through the garden and tell them, like, you know, this is sage, this is tarragon, this is rosemary, this is lavender, this is Melissa, this is... people always think I'm, like, super attached to it. So there's a good laugh there. But I love lemon balm also for crushing into citrus marmalades.
Ooh.
Just to add another lemon component. Mm-hmm. I like them for teas. I've made a lemon balm kombucha. Actually, that was I did a concentrate with a ton of lemon balm and a SCOBY until the SCOBY picked up the lemon balm flavor, and then I dehydrated that so it was like little lemon balm gummies.
Wow.
I just like having it around, and I like touching
them.
It.
I love touching it.
I feel like that's enough of a reason, but yeah.
That's pretty
yeah.
cool.
Also, lemon verbena is so lovely. But for me, at least, maybe you can give me a tip. Lemon verbena has been less sturdy than my lemon balm.
Well, you might have seen one as you walked up the steps to my front porch. It does turn yellow and drop its leaves at least once a year. And,
yeah.
And it gets leggy and kind of funky looking. But it when it's looking good... I've used it. I've made a ice cream with it, which
yeah.
you just steep it in the cream
so
and then
beautiful.
Strain it out, and it's so delicious.
So delicious.
And I have that recipe on gardennerd.com.
perfect. Run, don't walk. Ice
yes.
cream.
So it is tip time. Do you have a favorite tip that you'd like to share with the Garden Nerd audience about anything, really?
Anything. I recently heard this wonderful quote by Dolly Parton.
Okay.
that was find out who you are and do it on purpose. And I thought it was so great, but it also reminded me of this fun question I like to ask people, professionals or home cooks, or, you know, if you're alive, which is, if you are going to make yourself food, which at some point you will, and you have a new ingredient and you don't know what to do with it, what's your instinct? And I think it says a lot about a person. So some people will fry it, some people will like boil it, some people will just eat it raw. Like, just what's your instinct? And I know mine is always to eat it bread, to make it into bread.
To, like, make it into a bread.
Yeah, whatever it is, I will try and like chop it up or boil it or whatever it is. But my goal is to make it to bread. and that way, I'm always interested in anything I see because I think, well, how can I make this into bread? And even if I don't, it makes me think about it enough that I become very creative about it. And I think this is a good gateway for people. I think if you think about what your instinct is, even if, like, if it's to fry it, to hell with the people who say don't eat fried foods. If that's going to make you experiment and at least begin to think about it, that practice alone will make you start being more confident in your creativity. And I think that has a good chance of getting more people to cook just for the fun of it. And I think we underestimate how important it is to have fun.
I love that tip. Thank you for sharing that.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me. This was so fun and such a treat to get to talk again with my old teacher.
Yes, it's been delightful. So how do people find you?
So you can find me online at eatredbread.com, and you can get some of those great cookies and preserves, and we sell a lot of gently used bakery equipment if you are trying to bake things yourself.
And it's delivered, right?
It's delivered nationwide. If you want to try out some of those grains, I'd visit Kristen Toll, but you can also follow my adventures and see what I'm baking on Instagram at redbread or at T. Rose Lawrence.
Excellent. All right, garden nerds, you'll find a link to Red Bread on gardennerd.com this week. We'll post a link to the bakery's social media channels, and which are drooltastic photos, by the way, I assure you. That's it for this week. Subscribe to this podcast on iTunes or wherever you listen. Visit us for tons of gardening information on gardennerd.com. Show your support for this podcast and other free stuff that we do at Garden Nerd by becoming a Patreon subscriber. You'll find us on Instagram and Twitter under GardenNerd1, on Facebook as GardenNerd.com, and of course, our Garden Nerd YouTube channel. Happy gardening!